Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Today we're going to find how a vegetable extract can treat autism better than drugs. Who says? Harvard Medical School. That's just one of many studies, all from peer-reviewed journals, we'll be sharing with you today. Plus a little more in-depth about why you shouldn't try to boost your brain dopamine and hurt yourself in the process unless you know what you're doing. So we're going to show you how to do it in a healthy way. Why is that important? Because dopamine is your brain's feel-good compound. Now think of all the ways we do that artificially, and I'll explain why those are all wrong. Also today I'm going to go a little more in-depth on magnesium. Magnesium's role in helping you have a healthy heart. After all, there are more than 300 enzymes performing vital functions throughout the body, and magnesium's benefit range from building bone to producing energy to synthesizing proteins. But it doesn't stop there. I'll give you more on that. But then today, we're going to take a look at some very interesting issues. We're going to take a look at the difference between the misinformation. Oh, if you had the vaccine, you're protected. Okay, what's their proof? The study's not over. But the adverse effects are coming in at an enormous rate, far exceeding what any mathematical model predicted. But they haven't told us any of that. They haven't had stories about the victims. We will. But now there's a brand new study, and I'll report on it. No significant difference in viral load between vaccinated and unvaccinated, asymptomatic and symptomatic groups infected with the SARS-2 Delta variant. Well, that changes the scenario, or should. And by the way, when they say it's really safe, just one reporting system in Europe, just Europe, not the United States, not Great Britain, nowhere else, 26,041 deaths, 2,448,362 injuries, and following the European Union's database. And so that is not safe or effective. So we'll give you the lowdown on that. But then we're going to do some interesting, insightful things. We're going to show you a senator, Nino Vitale, V-I-T-A-L-E, it's short, but he is in a field out west, mid-America somewhere, and he has a little device. Now, this is a device used in industries, and it shows when your oxygen supply goes low. And beyond a certain threshold, it sets off an alarm, because otherwise you're going to suffer from oxygen deprivation, which can cause all forms of brain damage that are permanent. So he brings in some teenagers from a local school, and they all have different types of masks, N95 masks and all the others. And he asks them just to put this up under the mask, which they do. And then you see the results. Now, mind you, yesterday we played a tape with Dell Bigtree and his son showing that no matter what mask he used or type, the carbon dioxide coming out went to 10,000 parts per man, which was extremely dangerous. And yet that was under 30 seconds. Imagine wearing that for 6, 8, 10 hours a day, as children are expected to do now in schools. Now we're showing you the other side. So it's creating a terrible environment for carbon dioxide, destroying the brain. Now it's showing you oxygen deprivation, not enough oxygen, and that's destroying the brain. So then I'm going to also share with you one of the world's leading authorities on this, a neurologist from Germany, and you'll see what she has to say about these masks. And we're going to deal with other things as well, including the battle over free speech and the whole idea that identity politics has taken us by storm and is controlling so many of our personal decisions. So we're going to hear from one of the world's leading feminists, very liberal, and published in the New York Times and all the major newspapers. And I watched a debate that she had, and She is against identity politics, but see whether you agree or disagree with her. Now, I can promise you no one in the American media has put her talk on, nor have they interviewed her. I would think they would want to do that, but they haven't. So we will. And we're also going to hear about a new rule from Bill Maher, if time permits. Don't segregate the national anthem. His views, again, agree or disagree, I think he makes some interesting points. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. Now, a recent clinical trial has shown that one vegetable extract can have astounding positive effects on those with autism, broccoli. In fact, the CDC tells the world that there is no treatment for autism spectrum disorder. Well, they're wrong. In fact, so wrong that in Washington, D.C., about, I think it was around 10, 11 years ago, on a stage at a very prestigious scientific forum where there were, I think, around 7,000 scientists from around the world, I was invited to be one of the keynote speakers based upon the results of a clinical trial that I had done on reversing the conditions that many women go through in menopause. There were 500 women. We met every week for 3 hours at Robert Kennedy Junior High, and we had phenomenal results, so important that it was published in a peer-reviewed journal as I was invited to speak. But I didn't speak about it. I brought out on stage three individuals, one suffering from end-stage Alzheimer's, who was now normal, one suffering from multiple medically irreversible conditions that had been cured, and then this tall young fellow, and his parents were there too, two New York City police officers, a nicer couple you'd never meet, the Ortegas, just wonderful people. And Jonathan's their son. And Jonathan had advanced autism spectrum disorder. I mean, really advanced. And they didn't know what to do. They called me. I put him on a protocol. Well, here he was. And I didn't tell anyone what these people had. But he came out and he had cards in his hand. Outstanding student of the week at a very prestigious school. And all these other achievements he had made. He was completely normal. And I said, and he had full end-stage autism spectrum disorder. They just couldn't believe it. So, and he's not the only one. But according to the CDC, there is no effective treatment. They are wrong. They don't know any. But others in this world do. But now that one in every 68 children is showing symptoms of the disorder, and that's a huge spike going right in combination with all the vaccines they're getting and all the aluminum and mercury they're bringing into their brain, then there's a need to look for a non-pharmaceutical medication or approach. And along with this extensive autism spectrum disorder research database, there's evidence suggesting that broccoli extract, along with avoiding heavy metals and minimizing glyphosate exposure and eradicating a diet of gluten, shows promise in improving autism spectrum disorder. Now, the active ingredient in broccoli that seems to help is called sulforaphane. You've heard me mention it many times, especially when you have cancer, because the cruciferous vegetables are your body's protection for that. So the molecule found in cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts is this sulfur-based compound. And the groundbreaking study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, our highest, most respected scientific institution in America. Quote, here's the title, Sulforaphane Treatment for Autism Spectrum Disorder, end quote. And it found that broccoli sprout extract significantly improved the behavior of boys and men, those who most often suffer from autism. And sulforaphane was selected in part because its physiological effects are well characterized and ideal for that. Quote, dietary sulforaphane of recognized low toxicity was selected for its capacity to reverse abnormalities that have been associated with autism spectrum disorder, including oxidative stress, lower antioxidant capacity, depressed glutathione synthesis, reduced mitochondrial function, oxidative phosphorylation, and increased lipid peroxidation and neuroinflammation, end quote. And this was a placebo-controlled randomized pilot study. All right, 46% of the participants had noticeable improvements in social interactions, and 42% had improvements in verbal communications. That is phenomenal. More than half, more than 50%, also showed decreases in irritability, hyperactivity, and repetitive movements. Mind you, this is just one item. But when I'm working with them, I'm using about 40 items. So just imagine if you got that huge a difference with one, think of all the others. But now it's Harvard. Now it's the National Academy of Sciences. What do you want to bet that everyone else in medicine, all doctors and scientists, CDC, FDA, don't mention this or deny it? And yet it's there in our most respected institution, peer review, Harvard. Huh? Because who can profit from broccoli sprouts? You can grow them in a week in your own home, and you should. Also, something you can grow in your home are microgreens. In fact, we just had a class yesterday. Angelo, who heads the microgreen teaching, showed people how to grow sprouts of all types and microgreens. There's about 40 different microgreens or more you can grow, plus other things hydroponically. These you can grow on your kitchen counter. You can grow them in your garage. You can grow them in your backyard. So that's one way to get something not just tasty, not just gourmet in restaurants where they'll put a little tiny sprig of microgreens on top of a plate to give it some decoration. Most people don't know what it is, just put it to the side. No, this is Penn State University, and they're saying that it's just not a gourmet sprout. It provides nutritional security. So we're looking now at the microgreen, which you can grow yourself in 15 days. It's rich in antioxidants, good source of chlorophyll, fiber, but it's got a lot of phytonutrients, and that's good. And they're finding that it really helps the body. It's a functional food. These are the new superstars. Now, you can get onion and garlic and almost any kind of sprout. You can get it as a microgreen. And they're, you know, mustard sprouts, the microgreens, and then it gives everything you put it into a flavor. In fact, yesterday we made some rolls with coconut flour in the rolls, and then put the microgreens inside with all other forms of wonderful vegetables and a grain. So you can do the same, but they're good for you. Now, from Cold Springs Harbor Laboratory comes a new study about how high-fat diets, that's most people's diet, allow cancer cells to go unnoticed. That's not good. A high-fat diet increases the incidence of colorectal cancer. That we know. And the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory fellow, collaborators from Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, had discovered that in mice, fat disrupts the relationship between intestinal cells and the immune cells that patrol them looking for emerging tumors. Reconfiguring the gut microbiome may be a way to heal that relationship. So, you want the body to look at and destroy abnormal cells. And a healthy bacteria in the intestine, meaning get rid of the sugar, the alcohol, the high saturated fats, and everything else you're eating, gives you that. Then your body is better able to have its immune cells locate abnormal cells. In fact, the team did all this and found that clean up the gut and you help the immune system tremendously. All right? And finally, people who supplement with vitamin C have greater mental vitality, according to Seoul National University in South Korea, published in the European Journal of Nutrition. And how much were they taking to help them overcome fatigue, attention, work engagement, and self-control resources? All were evaluated over a four-week period. Just 500 milligrams of vitamin C twice a day, and that was compared against a placebo for the 4 weeks. So it made a big difference. Big difference. So take your vitamin C. That's a very small amount. That's just 1,000 milligrams a day. And with COVID and everything else going on, and this new super cold strain that's going around, I suggest taking at least 4,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day and up, spread throughout the day, and that can help. And University of California, San Francisco, happiness in early adulthood may protect against dementia. This was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So the more positive experiences, the more remarkable experiences, and the less stress as children, the less likely are to have depressive symptoms. And they looked at 15,000 people between 20 and 89. They said the three stages of life, the older, midlife, and younger adult, that this applied, it can be very predictive. So happy experiences early on, longer life later on. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm going to save my comments on boosting brain dopamine naturally and magnesium for tomorrow, because we have so much else to share, but I'll get it in tomorrow. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to go to a clip. And this is an interesting clip. This is, you can watch it. You go to prn.fm, scroll down under notes, and there are all my notes for the day and lots of articles I can't get to, but they're there to help you. And all of them come from respected peer-reviewed journals. And watch the senator as he does this simple test that the masks are creating oxygen debt, oxygen deficiency, and that can have permanent effects upon the brain. Please stay with us.
This is State Representative Nino Vitale. We're here today to talk about oxygen deprivation and mask usage. We're out here in the middle of a field in Champaign County. It's a beautiful 70 degrees this evening. We're next to 100-acre woods. And what we have here is an instant oxygen sensor. This senses different types of gases, and if it senses anything above or below the normal level, this GX2009 made by RKI, you can look up this unit, will beep and it will tell us if there's a problem. Now, as you can see, 19.5% is what OSHA recommends as safe. Anything below that is considered unsafe. This unit will beep if the oxygen level drops below that. Right now, you can see it's at 20.9, so it's above safe levels. And we're going to bring in our first student because, of course, the public health experts are recommending that our students wear masks. So we're going to take the GX2009. We're going to put it up inside the mask and just have our student breathe normally here and see if it starts to. Okay, you can see that this started to beep right away. Let me see if I can show the percentage here. 17.1 is what it shows. Let me see if I can get that peak. Okay, there it is. It actually was lower than that at 17.0. So we're again 19.5, and you can see how quickly that was. Thank you. We're going to bring in student number two. Let me clear the peak on this because this does have a memory. So I'm just going to hold the air button here and clear that. Okay, so now you can see our peak is back to 20.9. And we're going to bring in our second student with the N95 mask. This is the 3M N95 mask. A little harder to get this in because this one's a little smaller mask. But do your best to put this up underneath your mask near where you breathe there, and we'll see what happens. Again, oh, okay, there we go. Almost immediately from breathing, it's sensing. Okay, thank you. Now let me get to the peak screen where it has the memory on it. Okay, there's the peak of 18.1. So almost immediately, this is dropping below what is considered safe by OSHA. And now we're going to bring in our third mask, our third student with a different type of mask. This is just your standard surgical mask. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to clear this because I want to make sure everybody knows. So the peak now is 20.9. We're back clear. Let me get back to the reading screen. Okay, now it's in active reading mode at 20.9 as well. And then if you would do the same thing, we're going to have student number three here just put it up under his mask and just try to put the mask back as best. Okay. Thank you. All right, and it was showing in the 17s here. I'm going to try to turn the alarm off, go to the peak screen. Okay, that one, 17.6. So as you can see, the 19.5 is what OSHA considers the danger level. And on all three of the tests, we did a straight surgical mask, we did an N95 mask, and we did a very thin mask of the first student. Can you hand me that? I just want to show how thin that mask is. Yeah, the gray one there. That's great. I mean, this was the first one. This is very thin material, and it's still trapping.
So just so you understand, there are coaches and schools demanding that kids who are playing soccer wear a mask, and they're breathing. That runners on a track wear a mask, this is insane. This is no longer, nothing is any longer about science and public health. It's about politics and control over our lives. And this is just showing you the reality. Now, if this person did it, and Dale Bigtree showed you the carbon dioxide buildup, imagine you're getting two things simultaneously. You're getting a massive amount of toxic carbon dioxide, which can cause brain damage, and you're getting an oxygen deprivation, which can cause brain damage. Two things simultaneously, and that was under 10 seconds. Imagine after 8 hours how little oxygen is going to be available and how much you breathe in carbon dioxide. So now we're going to show you something that no one at the New York Times will show you, those dancing fools, nor anyone on CNN, nor anyone, nor Rachel Maddow, or anyone else who is in the pocket of the establishment. And shame on them, because they're all intelligent, well-educated, and at some point in their career, cared. But now, no, they're just going right along with whatever they were told to do. So here is what a German neurologist says on face masks. Quote, oxygen deprivation causes permanent neurological damage. Quote, the delusional madness of forcing children to wear face masks blatantly ignores expert warnings. Quote, the child needs the brain to learn, and the brain needs oxygen to function. We don't need a clinical study for that. That is simple, indisputable physiology. This is well-known German neurologist, neurophysiologist, Dr. Marguerite Bryson, B-R-I-S-S-O-N. She warns of a tsunami of dementia years down the road because of oxygen deprivation from wearing masks today. Are you willing to risk your brain to scientifically unfounded, politically motivated mandates? By the way, she's just not anyone. She is an MD, a PhD, consultant neurologist, neurophysiologist with a PhD in pharmacology, with special interests in neurotoxicology, environmental medicine, and neuroregeneration and neuroplasticity. This is what she has to say about face masks. Quote, the inhalation of our exhaled air will without a doubt create oxygen deficiency and a flooding of carbon dioxide. We know that the human brain is very sensitive to oxygen deprivation. There are nerve cells, for example, in the hippocampus that can't be longer than 3 minutes without oxygen. They cannot survive. The acute warning symptoms are headaches, drowsiness, dizziness, issues of concentration, slowing down our reaction time, and reactions of cognitive systems. However, when you have chronic oxygen deprivation, all of those symptoms disappear because you get used to it. But your efficacy will remain impaired and the undersupply of oxygen in your brain continues to progress. We know that neurodegenerative diseases take years or to decades to develop. If today you forgot your phone number, the breakdown in your brain would have already started 20, 30 years ago. And while you're thinking that you have gotten used to wearing your mask and rebreathing your own exhaled air, the degenerative process in your brain are getting amplified as your oxygen deprivation continues. The second problem is that the nerve cells in your brain are unable to divide themselves normally. So in case our governments will generously allow us to get rid of the mask and go back to breathing oxygen freely Again, in a few months, the lost nerve cells will no longer be rejuvenated. What is gone is gone. I do not wear a mask. I need my brain to think. I want to have a clear head when I deal with my patients and not be in carbon dioxide-induced anesthesia. There is no unfounded medical exemption for face masks because oxygen deprivation is dangerous for every single brain. It must be the free decision of every human being whether they want to wear a mask that is absolutely ineffective to protect them against a virus. For children and adolescents, masks are an absolute no-no. Children and adolescents have extremely active and adaptive immune systems, and they need a constant interaction with the microbiome of the earth. Their brain is also incredibly active, as it has so much to learn. The child's brain, or the youth's brain, is thirsty for oxygen. The more metabolically active the organ is, the more oxygen it requires. In children and adolescents, every organ is metabolically active. To deprive a child or an adolescent's brain from oxygen, or to restrict it in any way, is not only dangerous to their health, it is absolutely criminal. Oxygen deficiency inhibits the development of the brain, and the damage that has taken place as a result cannot be reversed. The child needs the brain to learn. The brain needs oxygen to function. We don't need a clinical study for that. An absolute medical contraindication in medicine means that this drug, this therapy, this method or measure should not be used and is not allowed to be used. To coerce an entire population to use an absolute medical contraindication by force, there must be definite and serious reasons for this, and the reasons must be presented to competent interdisciplinary and independent bodies to be verified and authorized. When in 10 years dementia is going to increase exponentially and the younger generations couldn't reach their potential, it won't help to say we didn't need the masks. How can a veterinarian, a software distributor, a businessman, electrical coal manufacturer, and a physicist decide on matters regarding the health of the entire population? Please, dear colleagues, we all have to wake up. And it goes on from there, and I have the full letter, end quote, from the doctor. Remember, this is an MD, PhD, highly respected, multiple publications, peer-reviewed journals, a professor. She's got it all. Her name is Dr. Marguerite Greisz, G-R-I-E-S-S-Z, Bryson, B-R-I-I-S-S-O-N, MD, PhD. So, why haven't we heard any of the media interview her? Now, the two experiments done, yesterday and today, why hasn't any other media done the same? Because it would be going against Anthony Fauci. And oh, by the way, Anthony Fauci, they're trying to protect him at every turn. But what about the 200 scientists and doctors who call for an increase in vitamin D use to combat COVID-19? Yeah, 200. And this was sent out, and it has all their names. It says, quote, higher vitamin D blood levels are associated with lower rates of SARS-2 infection. Higher vitamin D levels are associated with lower risk of severe cases, hospitalization, ICU, and death. Intervention studies, including RCTs, indicate that vitamin D can be a very effective treatment. Many peer-reviewed papers and several biological mechanisms by which vitamin D influences COVID-19. And it goes on. And there are 200 doctors that signed on to this, and yet not a word anywhere in the media discussing that. But there it is. And then you have this. This is from Great Britain. 30,000 plus women in the United Kingdom report menstrual problems after COVID vaccines, but menstrual issues are not listed as side effects. This is from Dr. Lawrence Pavesky. Quote, if we were to follow the scientific method as it was taught in textbooks, we would immediately see this observation of menstrual cycle changes in tens of thousands of women as a signal for which necessary questions would need to be asked. So this is in the British Medical Journal, an editorial in the British Medical Journal last week. They're the ones telling you this. This is one of the most respected medical journals in the world. Women menstrual regularity, vaginal bleeding, massive amounts of bleeding in some women. And they had to report this because they have the EOLA card system, the UK system for collecting, monitoring adverse reactions following vaccine adverse reports. So that's just one of the things they're finding. And yet, it's not even listed as a side effect. But we'll tell you about it. And we had the reference to back it up. Oh, and by the way, the 6 feet? Yes. Well, according to Great Game India, 6 feet social distancing rule was completely made up out of whole cloth. Who says? The former FDA commissioner. According to the former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, the 6 foot social distancing rule was completely made up and arbitrary, and nobody knows where it came from. He was the former commissioner of the FDA, and he admitted during an interview on Face the Nation that the 6 foot social distancing rule recommended by public health officials for months on end was actually, quote, arbitrary in and of itself, and nobody knows where it came from. Okay. There you have it, the person who implemented it. He was the FDA commissioner, and everyone went along like lemmings. So, what does this mean? It means that with the masks and social distancing, they were wrong. Now, masks will protect against some microorganisms, but when it comes to viruses, just remember, you've got to look at all the physical factors. The size of the virus versus the size of the barrier. And in some cases, the barrier is 5,000 times larger than the microorganism you're trying to barricade out. Now, I wear a mask on planes. I have for a long time because I don't want someone coughing and sneezing and their mucus droplets going in the air and coming down. There's no place to go in an airplane. So you're like flying in a petri dish. And hence, I have a shield over my face, a hat on my head, gloves, long sleeve shirt, and a mask. And but it's not because of COVID. So anyhow, just information for you that'll give you more ways of looking at this. And by the way, another study, this reported by The Guardian, quote, nearly 9 in 10 young adults in the United Kingdom are now likely to have COVID antibodies. The estimates, which are for people 16 to 24, range from 86.9% to 88.7% in England and Scotland, with 87.2% in Northern Ireland. The presence of corona antibodies suggests someone has had the infection in the past or has been vaccinated. It takes between 2 to 3 weeks after infection or vaccination for the body to make enough antibodies to fight the virus. Okay, but the vaccine is only a partial, very short-term antibody protection because you're only getting a part of the antigen, the spike, where natural immunity is far more robust in protecting you. And yet, they still want to vaccinate you no matter what. And that's wrong. That's not science. That's not medicine. That's politics and profiteering. So keep that in mind. All right. Now I'm going to share something with you. And this is a legitimate but polite challenge to Amy Goodman and her Democracy Now! I absolutely respect her right to produce and promote anything she chooses on her show. And I've challenged her on her support of the White Helmets, a terrorist group, and her wanting to see Assange removed when it was actually America behind all that, not Assange, but Assad in Syria. A lot of things I hold a different point of view, but that's fine. We should have the opportunity to have multiple points of view. Now she's going against ivermectin, and a lot of media is going against ivermectin. So I want to share this with the hope that she will take a look at it, or her producers, and realize that maybe she could reevaluate her being against ivermectin. First, I suggest you take a look at an article in the Times of India, September 25th, 2021. The title is Uttar Pradesh, quote, COVID cases down 99% since peak. All right? And why? Because they were using ivermectin prophylactically. That's the story. All right, now you're talking about a huge number of people. But there's another article also. And this is from a Dr. Justin R. Hope, H-O-P-E, medical doctor. Ivermectin obliterates 97% of Delhi cases. Quote, a 97% decline in Delhi cases with ivermectin is decisive, period. It represents the last word in an epic struggle to save lives and preserve human rights. This graph symbolizes the victory of reason over corruption, good over evil, and the right over wrong. It is as significant as any. It is an absolute vindication of ivermectin and early outpatient treatment. It is a clear refutation of the World Health Organization, the FDA, the National Institute of Health, the CDC's policies of, quote, wait at home until you turn blue, end quote, before you get a treatment. And then it goes on to talk about how ivermectin, quote, obliterates this virus. Obliterates means to decimate, demolish, or annihilate. It means to eliminate or destroy all trace, indication, or significance. And the graph, and it's an official government graph that he has, shows that ivermectin used in Delhi beginning April 20th obliterated their COVID crisis. So that's what he has to say. Again, the article, which is posted on PRN.fm, is just part of the proof. But now we go to my own research on this topic, and just want to share this with you. We're posting all this today. Oh, by the way, there's also this newest study which shows that asymptomatic and symptomatic, the viral loads are virtually the same. So this whole demonization of people who are unvaccinated is, oh, well, what if those unvaccinated people don't want to get vaccinated because they already had COVID and they have natural immunity and the vaccine could actually harm or kill them by creating a hyperimmune response, especially if they already have some immune condition? This has got a lot of authors on it, this particular study, and I think about 20. And it's, quote, no significant difference in viral load between vaccinated and unvaccinated, asymptomatic and symptomatic groups infected with SARS-2 Delta variant. All right. And University of California, the Department of Biochemistry, Biophysics, University of California, Infectious Disease and Global Medicine, Division of HIV, Department of Medicine, University of California, all these different top scientists were part of this. Well, that should give us a whole different way of looking at those. So you can't say because you have been vaccinated that somehow you are in a different position biologically than the person unvaccinated when it comes to viral load. Now, the whole idea is you're not even taking into account what people can do for themselves. I believe that we have to look at what we can do preventatively on a daily basis, and that's within our power. And so what I'm going to do now is, by the way, I have two whistleblowers who have come forward who are going to share some information on my next Progressive Commentary Hour about all this. But just remember, here's the latest figures from one reporting system. This is not the United States. This is not Great Britain and other countries report on, Scotland, India. No, this is just European Union, quote, 26,041 dead. Now, mind you, just in that one report, that's another month and that'll equal all the, could equal all the casualties in the Vietnam War. And yet they say it's safe. What about the 2,448,362 they're reporting injured, including many with life-altering conditions? So when you say it's safe and effective, you're excluding all these dead? Now, normally, if any drug, any medical procedure kills 20 people, it's stopped. It's banned. That's it. Not just a black box warning. It's banned. So 20 people, you ban it. But 26,000 dead in one area, and it's fine. Let's not look at this. Let's not come by. It's safe and effective. Safe and effective. That's all politics all the time. And we should hold those people morally accountable for misleading us. All right? And so we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to go into hear what Bill Maher has to say on this. No, you know what? Instead of Bill Maher, I think it's important that we have a forum for someone. This is a very liberal, feminist, author, many books, many articles, but she has a perspective that you could agree or disagree with when it comes to the identity politics, which has been all the rage in the last 2 years. Before we go to that clip, I just wanted to add something else on to the evidence, because it seems like people who are against hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin say there's no evidence. Okay, I'm posting today evidence. On hydroxychloroquine, there were 344 studies. Of those, 250 are peer-reviewed and have been conducted specifically for COVID-19. 281 studies have been clinical trials that involve 4,583 scientists and over 407,627 patients. 64% improvement in 31 early treatment trials, 75% improvement in 13 early stage infection treatment mortality results, 21% improvement in 190 late stage infection treatment trials. That means the patient's in serious condition and approaching death, and yet there was a 21% survival rate if they took hydroxychloroquine. 190 different trials. 23% improvement in 44 randomized controlled trials. So think of all those studies, and they can't find any of them. Ivermectin, 131 studies, 52 peer reviews have been conducted specifically on COVID-19. 62 have been clinical trials that involved 613 scientists and over 26,398 patients. 58% improvement in 31 randomized controlled trials. 86% improvement in 14 prophylaxis trials. 72% improvement in 27 early stage infection treatment trials. 40% improvement in late stage infection treatments. Wouldn't you think that every hospital in America would have that when people come in? That's late stage. 58% improvement in mortality results, meaning 58% of the people in 25 separate mortality death studies show that they wouldn't die. Also, you have fluoxamine, 80% improvement in early treatment, 29% improvement in late stage treatment, and 63% improvement in all 7 peer-reviewed studies. Vitamin D. Oh, it's just a vitamin. No, there's 101 studies in the peer-reviewed literature conducted by over 875 scientists. There are 63 studies with 34,864 patients. There are 33 treatment trials with 860 patients. There's 42% improvement in 33 treatment trials. There's 56% improvement in 68 sufficiency studies. And there's 55% improvement in 19 treatment mortality studies. But by contrast, there have been 21 studies enrolling 35,744 patients with remdesivir trials showing only 22% improvement in all studies combined. This rate is below that of simply taking probiotics. 5 studies with 24% improvement in probiotics. Melatonin, 7 studies, 62% improvement. Curcumin, 4 studies, 71% improvement. Nigella sativa, 3 studies at 84% improvement. Quercetin, 4 studies, 76% improvement. Aspirin, 7 studies, 37% improvement. Now, mind you, all of these are better than what Anthony Fauci's produced, and also 25% of the people taking remdesivir in the studies died. So, death by orthodoxy and survival by these. So before you condemn something, maybe you ought to do a little more homework, be more objective, and not accept the biased opinions of others who say, oh, there's no benefit, there's no science. We've shown you the science, we've shown you the benefit. All that I've shared with you comes from mainstream science. It's not opinion. All right? Now, we'll listen to what that person has to say about identity politics.
Lives trying to evolve a nuanced sense of ourselves. But as far as the identity politics cabal is concerned, if you're an Anglo-Saxon professor of economics at UCL, with a child whose drug addiction has broken your heart, a sideline as a stand-up comic, and a passion for polka dancing, All you are is white. Worse, privileged, meaning you should be ashamed of yourself and none of your achievements are to your credit. For the term identity politics implies a worldview. The dogma couches human history exclusively in terms of unequal power relationships between groups. Thus, all of life reduces to human hierarchy. An individual's identity derives solely from membership of a collective. In the service of a revolutionary social justice, your rights will right to be heard, to avail yourself of social resources, and to defend your own interests depend entirely on your having been marginalized due to race, ethnicity, sexual preference, gender, or disability. Hilariously, the bulk of identity politics crusaders are actually well-off white people competing over who can be more righteous. I grew up during the civil rights and women's liberation movements in the United States. I was a fierce advocate of both. But the goal of these earlier campaigns was to break down the artificial barriers between us and to release us all into seeing each other not as black or white or male or female, but as individual people. Granted, with race and sex, we've still got a ways to go. But one of the greatest impediments to fully breaking free of our pigeonholes is the rise of identity politics. For we all fall into categories that weren't of our choosing. I was born white, female, and American. No one asked me beforehand whether I wanted to tick those boxes, and they are boxes. So I've never wanted these categories to define me, as I wouldn't want the categories into which the folks in this audience were unwillingly born to define you either. The color of my skin is an arbitrary accident, not a personal brand. As a woman, I often break the mold. I'm outspoken and sometimes unpleasantly aggressive. I dress badly. I even make a pretty lousy American, having spent most of my adult life in the UK. For me, the boxes into which I was born have been confinements I've struggled to get out of, and I would wish that liberation for everyone else. Identity politics urges us all instead to cling to the bars of our cages. In locating advantage and disadvantage, too, the movement pushes historically marginalized groups to deploy weakness as a weapon. Thus, you're strongly motivated to maintain that weakness, the better to push other people around with the unfairness of your terrible plight. Perversely, then, victims of racism, sexism, or homophobia, say, logically grow attached to the very prejudice from which they suffer, because prejudice translates into power. And without victimhood, they have no idea who they are. Ironically, the last thing the identity politics crowd wants to see is a truly equitable society. Absent bigotry, its activists would be lost. Identity politics doesn't eliminate human hierarchy, but simply flips the totem pole upside down. Thus, at the very bottom sit awful, undeservingly advantaged white people, and at the very, very bottom, white straight males, who, according to this creed, have no rights and no business venturing an opinion about anything, who are obliged to check their privilege, aka shut up. Well, I reject out of hand that any group should be told they have no rights and they have to put a sock in it. I happen to be married to a white, straight male, and I'm often very interested in what he has to say. According to identity politics, the sins of the father are visited upon the sons. If you're white, you accept responsibility for slavery, colonialism, and the slaughter of native peoples from Australia to America. But do we really believe in infinitely inherited guilt? Let's all be historically clear-eyed. But Germans coming of age today oughtn't to feel personally responsible for Dachau. Nor should any of us pretend to feel guilty about something we know perfectly well we didn't do. Have you noticed how many headlines these days involve race? How, as sociologists document a steady decline in racial prejudice, relations between races seem to be getting worse? That's because this movement is inherently adversarial. It thrives on enemies. Though ostensibly concerned with victimhood, its proponents gleefully seek victims of their own. Identitarians have created a cutthroat, predatory environment in which often anonymous, self-appointed culture police prowl the halls of the internet searching for perceived violations of their orthodoxies. Using the wrong word, reaching for the wrong pronoun, allowing that amidst all the plunder and domination, maybe countries colonized by Britain enjoyed one or two teeny tiny benefits, can now get you sacked. For this movement has issued in not the color and gender blindness we aspired to in my youth, but a hyper-awareness of race, gender, and ethnicity. Implicitly, the ideology pits disadvantaged groups against one another in a competition over who's been treated more badly. Rather than calling us to a shared community, it fosters a climate of anxiety, division, antagonism, touchiness, and paranoia. So in our universities, faculties are terrified to teach or publish anything that might conceivably step on a minority's toes. Self-censorship is rife, persecution common. In workplaces, employees negotiate a minefield of microaggressions and are afraid to make jokes. In my occupation, fiction is vetted by sensitivity readers, while many of my fellow writers are frightened of crafting characters different from themselves, lest they break a host of proliferating unwritten rules. In social settings, many of us have, if anything, grown less likely to approach a stranger of a different race, and not because we're bigots, but because we're fearful that we might inadvertently say the wrong thing. I don't call that progress. Inexorably, too, identity politics has conjured the boogeyman of white identity politics, now on the rise in the U.S. If we're all to understand each other in terms of our helpless membership of groups, white people are going to understand themselves in those terms as well. And it's interesting how unattractive it is to brandish your skin color as the most important aspect of your sense of self when white people start doing it too. Certainly, many of the folks staging this festival of taking offense are well-intended. We should all be alert to the fact that others may have experienced social and professional travails that we haven't. Yet surely the power dynamics of human hierarchies can't explain everything. Looking out the window and seeing only degrees of victimhood is a flat, oppressive, reductive, and depressing way of looking at the world. Sometimes it's a relief to think about something else. Architecture, color and light, outer space. So I, for one, do not plan on embracing my skin color or my gender or sexual preference as the sine qua non of my character. For I reject outright the very concept of identity that this poisonous, overtly racist and sexist outlook promotes. I like dancing to talking heads. I'm a big fan of Graham Greene, Richard Yates, and Edith Wharton. I've published 13 books of my own, and whatever their failings, those novels are a part of who I am. I love the word mellifluous. I overuse the word insidious. I have a weakness for pole dark. I'm a mediocre tennis player who makes up for her deficits on the court with sheer ebullience. That and more is my identity. So if anyone aims to put Lionel Shriver, straight white female, on my tombstone, I'm definitely getting cremated.
That's her opinion. And we value people having opinions, whether we agree or disagree in part or whole. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. For WBI, we have to say goodbye. We're continuing top of the hour. And while waiting for that, we have a special today, a terrific special. I haven't done this in a long time. Cruciferous stuff. Yeah, cruciferous stuff. Why that? Well, because I believe every day you need the phytonutrients that you find uniquely in cacao, which is chocolate, but also in spinach, in apple pectin, beet juice, broccoli, kale, parsley, turmeric, carrots, watercress, celery, cabbage, collard greens, Brussels sprouts, apple. How about that? That gives you a full spectrum of your phytonutrients and your cruciferous vegetables. So that's one. Plus, you're getting calcium and magnesium, because I find a lot of people need that and don't know that what their body's using it for. 120 vegan capsules, and you're getting 575 milligrams of calcium from citrate and 575 milligrams of magnesium from citrate. On top of that, you're also getting the most award-winning documentary in the world this year, The Cost of Denial, number one in the world. And I think it's headed towards 70 wins right now in official entrance acceptances. And this really goes through the pain, profit, and politics of our scientific community. Dozens of people interviewed from all over the world. You won't want to miss that. So it's a huge package. It's really good. And you're making a big savings. You're saving $99. That's right, $99. No, excuse me, you're saving $55. The total price is $99. So it's a big savings. Call to order your cruciferous stuff package with calcium magnesium. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Or call Neil at the Vitamin Closet. He's there Monday to Saturday, noon to 8 at 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. Let's just see if we have someone here who would like to give us their opinion. No calls? Oh, okay. Well, then no calls. I will end by saying that I'm still looking to hire the following people. In our office in New York, full-time, an internet marketing person, a bookkeeper, and a project manager. And you can send your resume and interest to prnstudio@gmail.com. That's prnstudio@gmail.com. I'm also looking to hire a person. Well, we're looking to hire someone for the villa as housekeeping to take care of the place, since I'm not here most of the time. And you'll call Luann Panesi for that, and we'll post her number. I don't have it in front of me at the moment. And also, I'm looking to hire a person that will just sit in front of videos all day and watch them and then decide where they go on a spreadsheet, so we can then have the ability to transfer that up on a computer, so people will be able to say, what do you got on heart disease? What do you got on dementia? And then we can scroll down and boom, you get it. And all the interviews are there, the protocols are there, the information's there, and there are thousands of them. And we're going to start by having someone work for 3 months. If it's good and they can continue on, there's a salary, not a big salary, but it's free room and board and a wonderful environment to work in. I can't do that by absentee. It has to be there because we have multiple monitors, because some of this stuff was filmed 30 years ago. And there's every single kind of tape we have a monitor for, and they're not all the same as they are today. So that's for the archivist. Again, you'll send your resume at prnstudio@gmail.com. We're out of time, everyone. Remember, this only works if you share what we share with you, if you find it of value with other people, so we spread the word, because no media is going to have any of this information on or us to debate. Have a nice day, everyone.